corporations in the world, and local farmers led an effort to ban the growth of GMO crops. But a recently passed state law, first written by the American Legislative Exchange Council, means that, for now, no other municipality in Oregon may do so. Where did the ALEC bill come from, and how was it passed? We take a closer look at ALEC in Oregon with a special report by KBOO's investigative news team on Jackson and Josephine County's GMO bans on Tuesday, June 24th at 5:45, right after the evening news.
And you are tuned to KBOO in Portland. It's just a few seconds past 11 a.m. Disability awareness is off today. Instead, we'll hear an excerpt from Peace Talks Radio, and they will be taking a look at how people with disabilities learn to manage their feelings about having a disability. The program also looks at how those with disabilities handle conflicts that they encounter interacting with others in society. And stay tuned at 11:30, host Sarika Mehta interviews writer Jean Kwok about her latest work, Mambo in Chinatown. And I want to thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, along with Suzanne Kreider, Peace Talks Radio co-founder and show host Suzanne Kreider, who experienced an AVM, an arterial venal malformation, in 2012. The temporary bleeding in her brain left her with some stroke-like symptoms of compromised movement and speech. She's returning to host today's program after a 2-year hiatus. So let's now hear part of Suzanne's interview with Dr. Susan Stutzner, professor in the Department of Leadership and Counseling at the University of Idaho. Dr. Stutzner herself suffered a spinal injury when she was 19 and has been a paraplegic using a wheelchair ever since, and teaching and studying about the world of disability. She's author of the book, Living with Disability, Finding Peace Amidst the Storm.
What does research say about persons without disability? Do they often have biases and insecurities about people with disabilities?
Yes, actually there are a lot of biases and insecurities by society and people without disabilities. People without disabilities may see someone who has a disability and then feel threatened. It's kind of like the person becomes a visual reminder of their own mortality, what they call death anxiety. There's others who live without a disability who may try to socially distance themselves from people with disabilities because they're concerned about being socially ostracized by their peers or friends. So that does definitely happen.
Talk more about this death anxiety. What is that?
Well, I think, because people are mortal, whether you have a disability or not, people have their own fears and insecurities. And so when someone who does not have a disability sees someone who does, they might have a conscious or unconscious thought such as, what if that happened to me? Or there's a tendency for people to want to blame the person with the disability because then it gives others reassurance that if they do all the right things, then a disability will never happen. But what people don't realize is that sometimes life just happens. You could make all positive choices and do all the right things according to our societal moral conduct and still have a disability.
You have a background of a disability as well as you understand the psychological reasoning because you have a counseling degree. So why do some people feel more like, oh my gosh, they feel their mortality more than another person who will not blame the disabled person.
Well, I think a part of that comes to the meaning that people ascribe to it. Within our own society, westernized society, people often view living with a disability as a negative thing, something that they would rather avoid, or that if it occurs, it's almost equated with a death sentence to the extreme. But what they don't understand is that many people with a disability find positive things that develop in their life because of their disability. For example, some people may report that they have a deeper level of friendship, or they have found a more meaningful purpose in life, or somehow their life has been positively transformed. Okay, so people who cope well have found a way to the other side so that their disability becomes a positive transformation.
What would you add to this list from your book, which, by the way, I agree with your list, and it's of things that non-disabled people shouldn't do if they want to make peace with disabled people. One of them is offer unwanted help. I hate that. Another is assume disabled people can't do something. And another one is make a disabled person into a superhero. Explain what you mean when you write, don't make a disabled person a superhero.
Okay, well, sometimes when you have a disability, people will treat you as you're Superman, you know, because you have defied the odds or you have overcome a situation that society or people without disabilities would deem amazing. And so they may say something like, oh, wow, you know, you're just great. I don't know how you do that. I could never do that. All right. The catch to this is that many people who I believe are well-meaning individuals who don't have a disability think they're doing something kind by telling you how great you are. Okay, and how well you're doing. But the harm is that the focus is only on your disability. It's not about, gee, you're wearing really great shoes today, or I really like your outfit. You know, some kind of conversation that would be normal among people who didn't have a disability.
Susan, explain what passing is.
Okay, sometimes people with a disability may feel the need to conceal or act as if they don't have a disability. Okay, so where you may see this is when someone has an invisible condition. Perhaps it's a mental health diagnosis or a learning disability, or maybe it's a health condition such as cardiac problems that maybe isn't noticeable to the average person. And so rather than have the attention focus on them and their disability, they will try to act as if it's not there. And so therefore pass as someone who doesn't have a disability.
I do that a lot, and it's really bad, but I walk kind of funny and I try to pass off like I'm walking normally. And I do that because I think I should have as a goal to mainstream back into the non-disabled world that I came from. So what should people do who are disabled instead of passing?
Well, I think a better option may be to be forgiving of yourself when you're not able to pass or to pass all the time. Certainly, people who have an invisible disability have the option of not disclosing or making their disability noticeable to other people. But when it's visible, people may do the best they can to conceal it. And I'm certainly not saying that a person shouldn't try to do that. But I'm also saying that it's important to be okay with who you are and to forgive yourself if you're not able to pass.
Sometimes when I'm walking on the street, a really fast driver will come by me and like they're like zooming by me. And inside of me, I get really impatient. And I feel that this is happening because I'm slow and I'm disabled. So honestly, I might yell at the driver. It's really embarrassing, but I do. Should I try to do something instead of yelling?
Well, I think you bring up a good point there, because I think a part of the ambiguity in coping well with a disability is knowing which battles to address, which battles are important and which ones to let go. Because if we chose to respond or stand up for ourselves every single time we were treated bad, I think we would be emotionally and mentally exhausted. So therefore, I think each person has to decide, is this a big enough injustice or inadequate treatment that I need to say or do something and point it out to the other person?
How does a person decide that?
I think it's a process. You know, we live in a society that expects people with disabilities to cope well and to automatically know how to deal with these interpersonal or external situations that they encounter as a part of society, but yet they're not given enough information or enough resources or enough assistance to know what that might look like. And so oftentimes it's a trial and error process. You know, it's somebody trying to stand up for themselves and then decide, well, that didn't work so well, so maybe next time I'll do something else. And certainly as a 19-year-old, I had a pretty Pollyanna view. I just thought, oh, people really don't mean what they're saying, or they don't really mean what they're doing. So I kept forgiving them, which isn't a bad trait, but the harmful side is it took me a long time to stand up for myself and to say, it's also important that I honor and be true to myself.
What do some of those moments that you refer to look like with other people when you stand up for yourself?
Okay, well, let's say that a person with a disability is going to college and they have asked for some sort of accommodation which has been denied. That is an opportunity for someone who has a disability to stand up for themselves, because certainly that is something that they need to equalize or enhance their learning within a university context. Another way that this might look may be in a personal level. Say someone has a disability and their own values or personal boundaries have been crossed. So let's say that someone standing up for themselves may decide to educate this person a little bit about their disability, or maybe they'll decide to answer it in a different way. For some people, as we talked about earlier, they will feel comfortable and they will feel it's best to educate others about their disability and that that helps bring peace. For others, that may not be what works for them. So maybe the standing up for them may be to tell this stranger or this person that they don't know something like, I can understand you being curious, and I definitely respect that. But, you know, this is something that I don't wish to discuss with people I don't know. So someone could say that in a kind, caring, non-offensive manner, and be true to themselves without fully disclosing every bit of information to this person. And so as a person with a disability, sometimes we have to be willing to cut people some slack. But by the same token, we also need to know when our rights have been violated and when it's important to stand up for ourselves. So it's a balancing act.
I request of people, ask any question you want. And I thought that was a good request to me because it teaches people to ask questions rather than telling me. It also gives me an opportunity to educate people. So what do you feel, or what does the research say is the best thing to do to make peace?
Well, I think you could ask 5 different people and probably get 5 different answers. There will certainly be some individuals such as yourself that feel it works better for them to educate people. And in my book, I talk about that, that really what is most important is to find what works for you. Within the research, we know that it helps to have a sense of humor, to not take yourself quite so seriously. And so sometimes if something is brought to your attention, or say your disability is brought to out in the open, if there's a way that you can use that situation in a humorous fashion to put people at ease, that tends to work a little bit better.
I wonder, are disabled people trying to fix things and make peace more so than non-disabled people, or is it the other way around?
That too is a good question. I think society kind of expects people who have a disability to make them comfortable. But, you know, I think what would be best is if both sides or both groups, you know, could take a certain amount of responsibility and do this in collaboration.
How can I collaborate? Let's say I have different friends. Do I just bring it up and say, let's collaborate on this?
Well, I think a good place to start is for people, the better someone with a disability knows themselves, the better they can teach others how to treat them. What I do is, with people who I'm friends with, I just know and trust that my situation will be talked about eventually, but it doesn't need, it's not the first thing that we talk about. And that's because the people who I've become friends with in my lifetime see me as a person and they want to know me for who I am. Then it may be 1 month, 2 months, 6 months down the road that we have some conversation and they let me bring it up according to whenever I want to. You know, in other words, they don't feel the need to learn about this part about myself until I'm ready to talk about it. If somebody, on the other hand, feels more comfortable in sharing it up front with their friends, then by all means do that. But I think it comes down to what each person values and needs for themselves.
Dr. Susan Stuntzner, do you feel that support groups for disabled people are helpful or not?
I think support groups can be very helpful because people don't know what to expect, you know, I think support groups give them a venue or an opportunity to hear other people's experiences. And then when people share their stories, they can say, oh yeah, I went through that. And so I think when people hear their peers' stories and they hear about strategies that they've tried, that can be very useful. And that's the value of support groups.
I'm so curious how people learn about how to treat disabled people. So is there anything you recommend that we could teach parents or educators on how to interact with people with disabilities?
Well, that is a good question. Within the public school system, that certainly a lot of learning could happen, you know, within the classroom, teachers, administrators, as they got more inclusive and more comfortable with students with disabilities or with introducing some of their students to professionals with disabilities so that they learn to see this as a more normalized experience, not just as something that happens by chance. I think also as parents, you know, certainly parents can learn to treat people with disabilities with respect, because children will model after their parents. So that is certainly one way to approach this. You know, another is, you know, just changing the whole societal framework of how we view diversity. I mean, we live in a country where we have mainstream values, but we are known to be a diverse culture. So my question is, why aren't we acting in ways that respect diversity? We're just not all going to look the same, act the same, be the same. And it's the ways in which we're different, you know, that make this a great place to live.
Dr. Susan Stuntzner, University of Idaho professor and author of Living with Disability, Finding Peace Amidst the Storm. Let's hear more voices and ideas that Suzanne Kreider collected from a 2013 Disabilities Issues Conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Dustin Berg from Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm a T7 paraplegic. I was in a motorcycle wreck in 2003 where I barely survived. I broke a whole bunch of bones, and my T7 vertebrae, which is roughly in the middle of my back, which caused paralysis. So I use a wheelchair now. You know, everybody, whether they're able-bodied or disabled-bodied, they can focus on a list of things they can do, and that can go on forever. Or they can focus on a list of things they can't do, and that list can go on forever. And it's just, which list are you going to focus on? And then, you know, for me, that was, you know, very big in my accepting my situation. And then, trying to abandon a lot of my fears about my situation and just go on with my life and try and pursue the opportunities that are available. And I realized that, you know, it's definitely not the end of my life, and I kept still very live a very full and fulfilling life. I try to look at everybody as equal, and why wouldn't I have peace with people that are able-bodied? I guess would be my question. I mean, they didn't do anything to deserve any kind of negative energy out of me. You know, a lot of them are very helpful and very caring, and I don't see why we would not have peace, I guess is what I would say.
In a Rolling Stone article, Michael J. Fox just said he has Parkinson's, and this is what he said at the end of the article. If I walked into a room with God or Buddha or Bill Gates or Sergey Brin or whoever could figure out a way to fix it for me, I don't think I'd do it. Because I wouldn't have gone through what I've gone through, and I wouldn't have had the experience I've had. What do you think about that? And would you change this if someone could change it?
I mean, that is a really tough question. I understand what he's saying, that you definitely grow as a person. You add tons of character, and you grow mentally in ways that you couldn't have grown without dealing with the experiences you've dealt with. I wish I could go back and walk, but then keep all the experiences and even the hard ones, because they've made me a better person. Man, that's a tough one, you know. I want them both.
What do you mean by a better person?
I guess the direction I've taken with my life because of my situation has actually made me more beneficial to society, because now I take disabled children out and I try and share outdoor experiences with them. I take a bunch of adults out and do different kinds of, trekking programs and stuff with people in wheelchairs. So I give back more than I probably would have. It's hard to tell, though. Who knows what I would have done? But going through what I've been through, it changed what was important to me, and being a positive piece of society became my number one goal.
Hi, my name is Jane Murray. I'm from McIntosh. It's east of the East Mountains. I have PTSD, fibromyalgia, and chronic fatigue.
So what is or was the hardest part about being disabled?
The fact that my disabilities are not obvious. I'm not missing any limbs. I'm not in a wheelchair. And so I look pretty normal. And that's what people usually say is, but you don't look sick. But there are things, and I would like people to know that not everybody has an obvious handicap, different disability, altered ability, or whatever you want to call it.
What do you say to a person who doesn't know you have an altered ability, and they say something stupid?
Well, if at all possible, I try to treat them with compassion because they don't know and they're not aware. And if I'm having a really bad day and I know that I will react badly, then I'll walk away. But if I have a chance to educate people, I will.
And how do you educate them? What do you do?
I just tell them basically the same thing I told you, that some people do not obviously have a disability.
So what motivates you to be peaceful in these relationships?
If we want to go into quantum physics here, which not many people do, we are all one, just because we look different, just because our atoms are arranged differently. We are all made of the stuff of the stars, the planet, the earth, the buildings, everything in it. We are all related and we are all connected. And whether we like it or not, the way we treat others is how we are treating ourselves usually.
From my experience, you know, I was not disabled until 16 months ago. I had a brain problem. And I had this problem of, should I go out and let people see me and maybe get angry? Because I get angry. Mm-hmm. Or should I stay in? So what advice do you have about that?
I would say that you might be able to work with the anger as long as you are aware that you are doing it. Something that's really helped is the mindfulness technique of being aware of your actions and being the part of you who is the watcher that watches your body and your ego and your emotions go at it. And you can learn to have a little distance to recognize it and then maybe change. Sometimes you can't change your thoughts, but you can change your behaviors. Sometimes that allows you to go out and live in the world, because I've learned from personal experience, isolation will make you even crazier.
What do you mean isolation makes you even crazier?
For me, it was thinking I didn't need anybody else or anything, that I was fully self-reliant. All it made was me was crazier and crazier, because I was alone all the time with my thoughts, which can tend to be destructive and negative towards myself. Did a lot of self-medication with alcohol, and I've since been sober almost 3 years now and learned that I do need other people, and there are things that I can learn from other people. I am learning there's different ways of looking at the world that can still be constructive, that there are different ways to do things that will still succeed. You know, it's like Rodney King said years ago, why can't we all just get along? Live and let live. So that would be the advice I have, but most people can't live with other people until they learn to live with themselves.
For longer, complete versions of all of the conversations with all of our guests on this program, check out the Making Peace with Disability episode from May 2014 on our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com, where you can hear all the episodes in our series going back to 2002. That's also where you can learn how to support this work with a tax-deductible contribution, sign up for a free newsletter, a free podcast, or order CDs of most programs, and find loads of other resources too. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. That helps too, and we'll keep you up to date. This series stays on the air because of support from people like you and from support by the Eric Oppenheimer Family Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation of New Mexico, the Paul Ray Peace Prize, and KUNM at the University of New Mexico. Nola Daves Moses is Executive Director of Good Radio Shows Incorporated. Allie Adelman composed and performs our theme music. For Suzanne Kreider, I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.
Tune in to KABU for the 27th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. KABU will again broadcast the entire festival from noon to 10 p.m., July 3rd through the 6th. The broadcast will also be carried by various stations of Oregon Community Media for statewide coverage of this Oregon Food Bank Benefit Festival. Again, July 3rd through the 6th, noon to 10 p.m. each day here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to KABU Community Radio. I'm Sarika Mehta, and today I'm chatting with author Jean Kwok, who joins us by phone from the East Coast. Jean Kwok is the acclaimed author of the novel Girl in Translation, which was published back in 2010. Her latest novel, Mambo in Chinatown, follows the story of a Chinese-American woman named Charlie Wong, who lives a double life in taking care of her family in New York's Chinatown, while also training as an aspiring ballroom dancer. Jean Kwok tends to share some similarities with her characters, having immigrated to the United States as a child, surviving a difficult childhood while learning a new language in New York. She currently lives in the Netherlands. Her book Mambo in Chinatown comes out tomorrow, and today is the first day of her tour. Jean Kwok, welcome back to KABU.
I'm so glad to be here.
So, speaking of some of the similarities with your characters, I recently learned that in between your bachelor's and master's education, you were in fact a ballroom dancer. And this is also evidenced by a YouTube video that is served as a promotional piece for your book. Tell us about your experiences with dancing.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that dancing was really not a part of my life for most of it, because I was a really poor child, and we lived in this run-down, you know, unheated apartment in the slums of Brooklyn after we moved from Hong Kong. And, you know, my family worked in a garment factory, so there was no